We are bringing together imperfect people in pursuit of a whole life. Welcome to the Pathfinder Church Message Podcast. This week, Pastor Dion shares his message from the Character Forge, where he's focusing on generosity.
So my family, we live in a ranch house, a ranch floor plan, single level floor plan. It's the only one in our neighborhood like that. And Jocelyn and I were really jazzed when we found it. Because we both grew up in houses like that. We tried to live in a two-story colonial for like a year, and we're like, this is not for us. We're ranch people. And so we found our house, and we love our house so much. But one of the drawbacks, I think it's the only drawback about living in a ranch, is that often they just tend to be a little darker inside the way they're built. There's just not as much natural light. And so we've been combating that by adding mirrors throughout the house. Right, it's a great design thing. Like mirrors are cool; they look nice, or they're kind of trendy. But also, they have this more practical purpose. They reflect light. They help make rooms brighter. They can even make rooms feel a little bigger. And so, we've just been adding mirrors all over our house. But I'll be honest; there might be another reason that we add mirrors all over our house. And I'll just keep this to myself personally. How do I say this? Because I am an appearance-conscious person. You're shocked, aren't you? And I like, before I walk out of the house, to be able to take one more glance in the mirror before I leave. Some of that might be because I've had to be on, you know, a platform in front of people all of my adult life, and then later see clips of myself on video, and there are moments where you're like, oh, I didn't know I looked like that today. And so that kind of teaches you some lessons. Or maybe I'm just maybe I'm a little vain, or maybe I'm more self-conscious than some people are. But recently, I read something that said that those of us who look in mirrors more often tend to be less happy in life overall. And people who look in mirrors less tend to be more happy. And I found that really, really interesting, because probably more than going through the world looking okay, because I mean, like, who wants to go through life just, you know, a mess and not knowing it? For me, more than going through the world looking okay, I really want to go through life happier. But the problem for me in believing that, even though it's some sort of correlation and they've studied it, is that if being happier or trying to be happier means I got to go through the world, go through life with, you know, messy hair, my shirt not evenly buttoned, you know, missing a button, we've all done that, or with, you know, spinach in my teeth, or God forbid, something gnarly like hanging out of my nose. Ugh. I don't understand how I could possibly be happier that way, right? You're like, no, thank you. It doesn't make sense to me that those things actually go together. And here's what I want us to wrestle with today, that all of us have in mind a way to get to happiness, or we have in mind a destination of what happiness might look like for us in life, what it would look like to live a happy life. And today, I want us to question what we think happiness looks like, or what we think it takes to make us happy. It might not be what we think. Today we're going to look at the final weekend in this series. We're going to look at Luke chapter 5, in the Character Forge. And this is a moment where Jesus calls some of his first disciples. And there's something really interesting that happens here. Actually, a few things, but let's look. One day Jesus was standing by the lake of Gennesaret. Now, if you kind of know your New Testament, maybe this is a new lake for you. It's actually the same body of water that you see throughout most of the Gospels. It's just by a different name here. So the Lake of Gennesaret is the same as the Sea of Galilee. It's the same as the Sea of Tiberias. And kind of depending on where you lived or your political persuasions, this was called different things. Can you imagine a body of water, you know, being argued about by political persuasions? So here Luke calls it Lake of Gennesaret, but it's the same thing as the Sea of Galilee or the Sea of Tiberias. And Jesus is standing there by this, you know, this massive lake that's really the kind of life-giving part of the northern part of the kingdom of Israel. What was the kingdom of Israel? And the people were crowding around him there and listening to the word of God as he was teaching. And he saw at the water's edge two boats left there by fishermen who were washing their nets. And he got into one of the boats, the one belonging to Simon, who later Jesus will rename Peter, and so he's kind of known as Simon or Peter, or sometimes Simon Peter. So he gets into Simon's boat, and he asked him to put out a little from the shore, and then he sat down and he talked to people from the boat. So this is kind of ingenious, you know, it's like crowded, people can't hear him, he's having a hard time speaking, and so he's like, hey, I'm just going to get in the boat, it's going to become my pulpit, I'm going to just go out a little bit from shore, and I'll teach people from the boat, then they can't crowd me. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, put out into deep water and let down the nets for a catch. Simon answered, Master, we have worked hard all night and haven't caught anything, but because you say so, I will let down the nets. Now, I don't know about you, but I hear a little bit, maybe I'm oversensitive to this, but I hear a little bit of, hey, preacher, why don't you stay in your lane? From Simon, right? Like, you can talk about the Bible all you want, but please don't tell me about how to fish. And yet, it turns out preachers, sometimes they know stuff, because he goes along with it and says, when they had done so, they put their nets down, even after trying all night and catching nothing. When they had done so, they caught such a large number of fish that their nets began to break. So they signaled their partners in the other boat to come and help them, and they came, and they filled both boats so full that they began to sink. I think it's safe to say that these guys, who were second, third, fourth, fifth generation fishermen, and this is likely a family trade passed down from generation to generation, that they and their ancestors had never seen a catch of fish like this. This is Guinness Book of World Records kind of stuff. And we all know fishermen, they love to talk about their big catches, right? And here these guys, they've caught so many fish in one moment that their nets can barely hold them, their boats begin to sink, they are so filled with fish. The region had never seen anything like this. It's remarkable. Which is why Simon Peter's reaction to this is so interesting. When Simon Peter saw this, he fell at Jesus' knees and said, go away from me, Lord. I am a sinful man. For he and his companions were astonished at the catch of fish they had taken, and so were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, Simon's partners, who were also later called to be disciples. Now, this is interesting. There's something culturally interesting going on here, maybe. Or maybe you've had a moment like this. See, for most of us, if Jesus had just done this for us, we would adopt him as our permanent good luck charm, wouldn't we? We'd be like, Jesus, you're going with me everywhere. In fact, next, we're going to go to the corner store and we're going to buy lottery tickets, Jesus. And here, why don't you put on this Chiefs jersey just, you know, for good luck for next week's game? We would do it. We would absolutely keep this guy near us. But here, Simon Peter's reaction is interesting because Simon Peter says, go away, go away. Go away from me, Lord. Like, what? Is this guy crazy? Jesus is making it rain. And he's saying, go away. Now, part of this may be that Simon Peter is, he knows he's in the company of greatness. And so he starts to become self-conscious. I don't know if you've ever experienced this, when you're in the presence of someone you really respect or admire, maybe it's a famous person that you meet, and all of a sudden you just, like, get all tongue-tied and forget your own name, like that kind of thing. Has that ever happened to anybody? Okay, no. For me, you guys are very unfriendly. I'm working hard up here. For me and Jocelyn, our first 2 years of seminary, we were blessed to live for free in the carriage house of a really well-known guy here in St. Louis, former Senator Jack Danforth. And so we lived in this little apartment carriage house at his house, and we lived there for absolutely free. He's such a generous family. I think so highly of the Danforth family, and specifically of Senator Danforth, just like a guy of integrity and faith and extreme generosity. So he had us live there for free, and it was just something he did to bless seminary students, because he himself was a lawyer, but also he is an ordained priest in the Episcopal Church. And so he went through seminary and law school at the same time, because, you know, why not? At Yale, no less. But he had us live there for free, and we only had to do a few things to kind of, you know, earn our keep. We just did a few small things. One of the things that we did is that I was the after hours airport drop off and pickup guy. I was his airport shuttle. And so I remember, you know, like, and it was so fun because I was like, I get one-on-one time with this guy who has, you know, known multiple presidents. I'd be picking him up from the airport when he's coming back from diplomatic missions in Russia and the Sudan. And like, I was just like, oh my gosh, this is so, and on the way there, I'd always be driving to pick him up. I'd be thinking about like all the things I wanted to ask him. I'd have this list of questions in my mind and I'd be like, oh, I'm gonna talk to him about this today. And then I get to the airport, and for half the time that we lived there, it was before 9/11, and so I would go right to the gate, and I would wait for him to come off the plane, and he would hand me his carry-on bag, and I'd take it and be like walking through the airport with Mr. Danforth, and people would be looking, and I'd be like, yeah, I'm with him. And then we'd get in the car, and he had me drive, and so I'd be driving him back home, and all of the questions that I had, suddenly my mind would go blank. And I would get all tongue-tied and weird and awkward, and I would overthink everything I said. And it went from being this thing that I was really excited about. Like, I'm so excited to get access to this guy, to just being this nerve-wracking thing. I couldn't wait to get home and just go and take a nap after that, because I was exhausted. Maybe that's what's happening with Peter here. Right? If you're in the presence of someone truly great, truly holy, someone truly miraculous, I think the natural reaction is to become a little self-conscious and to become a little like aware of your inadequacy. And so maybe Simon Peter's just saying, like, I need some space. This is overwhelming to me. Or maybe it is that Simon Peter senses what might be coming next, and he's trying really hard to avoid what's coming next. Because then Jesus said to Simon, don't be afraid, but from now on, you won't fish for fish, you'll fish for people. In other words, I'm calling you into a new life. So they pulled their boats up on the shore. They left everything, their dad behind, the boats filled with fish, all of the gear, and they followed him. Maybe Peter saw this coming and he was trying to dodge it. Because what an extraordinary ask for some guys who just hit their biggest moment of their careers to say, hey, now leave all this and come and follow me. Today, we're talking about our final character trait in this series, Character Forge. We're talking about generosity, something that the world desperately needs. And when I say desperately, here's some stats on the state of generosity today. And by the way, up here is our generosity journey. If you get bored listening to me, just look at the map. 62% of religious households in the U.S. give to charity. That's compared to 46% of the unaffiliated households, or households that claim no religion. So if you put all those numbers together, you're like, okay, about half of U.S. households give anything to charity. Only half. If you just zoom in on the religious households in America, church-going households, give $17 per week on average per churchgoer. That's $884 a year. Meanwhile, the U.S. combined wealth that Christians make in a year is $5.2 trillion annually. Now, I looked this up. I was like, this is a lot of money. How much money is made in the world any given year annually? And right now, it's about $84.7 trillion. So this is only about 6% of the overall wealth of the world, but Christians in America only make up about 1.5% of the world's population. So I know that's a lot of numbers. It's fine. Just know that we're a small percent of the world's population, U.S. Christians. But we actually have a large amount of money at our disposal. And then, just to frame this for you maybe a little further, most of us here listening to these words, in person or online, most of us are in the world's wealthiest 10%. And not America's wealthiest 10%. Talk a lot about that, but we are in the world's wealthiest 10%. So just take that in. Now, when we talk about generosity, so often we talk about financial generosity, but generosity, of course, is bigger than that. So I want to talk about something else that we're called to be generous with, and it's actually something that we all have the same amount of, so it makes calculating easier. I want to talk about what it looks like to be generous with our time, and specifically what it would look like if we decided to tithe on our time. Now, tithing is a biblical concept that says you give 10% of whatever you have back to God. You give it away. You're generous with 10% gross of what you have. So we all have the same amount of time. So what would it look like if we started tithing on our time? Can you imagine giving away 2.4 hours each day? Not to your family, not to your, but like just giving that time away to serve other people. Or if you look at it a week, 16.8 hours a week. If you look at it in the course of a year, that'd be 50 days per year. Now, when I say 50 days per year, I'm talking about we give you just enough time to sleep and the other 17 hours a day are spent giving your time away. Or if you don't like that idea of working 17-hour workdays, you just want 8-hour workdays, it'd be 109 workdays worth of giving your time away. You have to figure out how to do the other stuff in the off time. In the course of an average lifetime, 10.7 years. Now, suddenly, giving your money seems way easier, doesn't it? Like for me, I'm like, oh, wow. Wow. And my goal here isn't to be like shaming or heavy-handed. I never want to be that way. And if I ever am, I'm sorry. You can tell me about it and I'll be sure to apologize. But today I do need to be clear about something. And what I need to be clear about is this, that generosity is an expectation for the Christian life. It's an expectation for the Christian life. Jesus makes that clear when he calls his disciples in Luke chapter 5. If you're going to follow him, there's a cost, there's an expectation. You're going to have to leave some things behind. He makes it even clearer in Luke chapter 9. You might know these words. He said to them all, whoever wants to be my disciple, if you want to follow me, if you want to be known by my name, if you want to be called a Christian, here's what you got to do. You must deny yourself, take up your cross daily, and follow me. Then he says this, whoever wants to save their life, whoever wants to hold on, whoever's afraid of being generous with their life, they will lose it. But whoever is generous with their life, whoever loses their life for me, will save it. And then he goes on and he says, for what good is it for someone to gain the whole world and yet lose or forfeit their very soul, their very life, their very being? Do you see that? Jesus says that the call to follow him, if we want to be his disciples, and there's no pressure, this is your choice, you get to make this decision, do you want to follow Jesus? But if you say yes to it, then you're being called to an entire life of generosity. See, a Christian is not permitted to move through the world driven solely by comfortable self-interest. Again, you're free to do whatever you want, but if you want to be a disciple of Jesus, if you want to be called by the name of Christ, then that means something. It means that you're not permitted to move through the world driven by whatever is most comfortable to you or whatever is in your own self-interest. And here's why. Because we follow Jesus, the one who first gave up all of his divine glory to become like us and then gave up his very life to rescue us, to save us, to reconcile us. And if that's what he did, the one that we follow, our master, if that's his way of life, a whole existence dedicated to generous living, then if we want to bear his name, if we want to claim to be followers of his, if we want to say that we're Christians, then we at least have to try to be like him in this way. That's really what this whole series has been about. That there's this disconnect so often in us between who Jesus is, who we clearly see him to be, and what we aspire to be. And we're just trying to set the record straight here to say, hey, again, you're free to live whatever life you want, but if you want to be a follower of Jesus, a disciple of Jesus, and if you're going to claim his name and wear it around in this world, then you actually have to try to be like him. And none of us are going to do it perfectly because we're imperfect people, right? We're imperfect people in what? In pursuit of a whole life. But we're imperfect people, so we're never going to do it perfectly. But we're called to actually try. But I'll be the first one to admit that in all the things we've talked about, you know, humility and righteousness and endurance and hope and generosity, I'll be the first one to admit that it is not easy. 20 years ago, I was an ordained pastor serving in a church, and Jocelyn and I, we gave nothing to that church. We gave nothing to any other charity. I was in charge of teaching stewardship, financial generosity to the congregation as a part of our discipleship, and I was giving nothing to that church. And here's why. I wasn't trying to be a hypocrite. Here's why. I just didn't believe I could. I didn't believe it was possible. We didn't have hardly any money. Like, we were maxed out. But if I really examine that belief and say, you know, I don't think we had the money, I don't believe we could, here was the underlying belief, that if I were to be generous like Jesus commands, then I'd be far less happy. When I say that we couldn't do it, of course we could, but I didn't know how we could be generous like Jesus commanded and live a good life that I could actually be happy with. I assumed that if I followed Jesus' command in this way, I would be absolutely miserable. But then because I was in charge of, you know, like teaching this stuff, I'd have to go to these conferences and listen to teachings. And through some hard and uncomfortable teachings from Bible teachers and just wrestling with hard scriptures, I eventually came to see that this isn't true. This isn't true. That actually, if you trust Jesus, if you follow him, it's actually the key to living a richer, more abundant, more fulfilling life. And so my hope today is that in the same way I had to encounter some hard teachings that were uncomfortable, they kind of made me frustrated or mad sometimes, I found myself just kind of speaking back, being like, but you don't understand the situation I'm in. And I had to wrestle through that. My hope is that in the same way that eventually God used those things to soften my heart and to change my view, I'm hoping that God might do the same thing for you today, that he might soften your heart on this issue for your own sake so that you can live a richer life, but also for the sake of our movement so that the world gets to see in those of us who bear the name Christ, Christian means little Christs, so that the world gets to see in us more of the character of the one whose name we bear. So if that's something you're at least open to, stay with me for the rest of this. If not, please just stay in the room and try to open up your heart to this. So what would it look like for us to forge generosity? The first thing is a simple but powerful. Notice how well God has provided for you. Just notice how well God has provided for you. I love how James puts it. He says, every good and perfect gift is from above. Right? Everything good and perfect in your life is not an accident. It is not there by chance. It is from above, not just from above, from the universe, but it comes down from the Father, your heavenly Father, the Father of the heavenly lights. It is a gift of love from a Father in heaven who loves to provide for his children. Now, this morning I saw a headline, and you know, it's like talking about trade wars and how everything's going to get more expensive, and I didn't even read the article. I just felt myself starting to panic because here's this narrative that we're living in right now, that life is really expensive, and it's gotten more expensive for sure, but this narrative that we're living in right now is that it is a struggle for a lot of us just to keep our heads above water. And I get it. I feel that struggle sometimes as I'm trying to raise a family, but I think we also have to examine the reality of that water line that we're talking about, that line that we're barely able to keep our heads above. Because here's what's true. That although there may be people in our nation who are malnourished from a lack of eating healthy food or eating too much bad food, virtually no one in our nation is starving. And yes, I get it. Healthcare is really expensive, and it may be out of reach for a lot of you. But over the last 70 years, the life expectancy of the average American has dramatically increased. We, by and large, I think probably universally, we have access to clean water. We're not slopping our own sewage. Most of us have access to some kind of shelter. We have access to transportation, if not our own personal transportation, to public transportation. And then if that weren't enough, like that's head above water kind of stuff. But if that weren't enough, in our pockets, we all have these magical screens that contain more information than any of the libraries of the world have ever had, more entertainment than the greatest kings and emperors had ever throughout history had access to. So can we just acknowledge that, yeah, life can be a struggle, but the struggle is not to keep our heads above water for most of us. The struggle is to keep up with the Joneses, and that's different. And I get it. Like, I still want good things for my family, and so I still feel the struggle. The struggle is real. But like Rona said earlier, if we can recalibrate our expectations or just even our vision from looking at what we lack or what other people have or how the things that we have are harder and harder to keep, maybe we can just notice what we have and notice that a loving Father cares about us enough to provide all of those things. In fact, I want to encourage you to do that right now. I just want you in the screen of your mind to just take a second and to notice, to focus on how well provided for you have been by God. And maybe you see that place where you get to rest your head that's safe and secure. Maybe you see your family. Maybe you see the meal you ate last night or what you're expecting to eat later today. Maybe you see a world that we get to live in that's pretty darn safe and beautiful, and just notice how well provided you are. And then take it a step further. Don't just notice, but just take a second and actually thank. Can you just right now thank your Father for being a great provider? I don't think I do this enough. I ask for daily bread a lot, and I say thank you when God shows up for it, but I don't take the bigger step back and just say, Father, I see the big picture now. Thank you for being a great provider. This is what we've been singing about all day. Can you just in your heart right now tell him that? Thank you, Father. You are such a great provider. See, if we can just begin to notice how well God has provided, it'll begin to change us from the inside out. Second, if you want to forge generosity in your life, trust that he's steering you toward what's good. I love Psalm 16. Speaking of God, it says, you make known to me the path of life. Like, this is not a mystery. It's not some secret treasure map that I can't figure out that's in code. You say plainly to me, God, what the path of life looks like. And you will fill me with joy in your presence, with eternal pleasures at your right hand. God, you make clear to me the path of life. You fill me with joy. You want to give me a life that's actually rich and pleasurable. Can we all just agree for a moment to stop this whole thing, just to stop pretending that the one who came into the world and gave his life for us is somehow trying to screw us out of a good life? Can we? And you know what I'm talking about. Like, I understand being cynical. I think everybody in the world is trying to exploit me. I really do. Like, I think everyone's trying to get over on me. Everyone in the world except Jesus. See, Jesus, this God who comes into the world and doesn't demand a hospital for his birth or a nursery or even a nice crib. Jesus, who comes into the world as a king but doesn't demand a palace or a throne or taxes or tribute. Do we really think that Jesus is out to exploit us? Or can we just agree that actually he's demonstrated everything we need to see that he's actually a generous and good God and we can trust him? Can we just stop playing this bit where we say, yeah, Jesus, but if I really trust you, if I took you at your word, if I did what you commanded, I know what would happen. I would be broke and I'd be miserable. Really? Can we keep saying that in our minds and our hearts to a God who if he wanted to exploit you, he wouldn't have been exploited in your place? If he wanted to deprive you of a rich, full life, he would not have allowed himself to be deprived of the very breath of life as he was hanging on a cross, suffocating, not able to take a breath. Willingly, he would not have been deprived of the breath of life so that you, when you breathe your final breath, wouldn't die, but you'd live forever. Like if he wanted to exploit you, if he wanted to deprive you, you can't explain how he lived his life and everything that he did for you. I get the cynicism. I don't trust big pharma or big agra or big government. Like, I don't trust anybody. I think everybody's trying to exploit me except Jesus. And can we just agree that his life, this generous life he lived in his very death, can we agree that someone who has demonstrated to be trustworthy and good like he has, can we agree that even when his words seem hard sometimes, hard to believe, can we trust that he's steering us towards what's good? Finally, if you want to forge generosity in your life, try out generous living. Now, I'll tell you, most things in the Bible were encouraged not to test God. Like, you shouldn't test God. Like, he's got to, like, do tricks or prove himself to you. Except there is one place where the Bible explicitly says that we should test God, and it's in generosity. Look at Malachi 3. Bring the whole tithe, again, that's 10% of what you've received from God, share that back, and bring it into the storehouse. And remember, wealth in these ancient worlds, I mean, just think about this, wealth in these days was purely in the amount of food that you had. So you were wealthy if you had food, more than a day's worth of food. That was wealth. And so bring the whole tithe into the storehouse that there may be food in my house. Test me in this. Try me out, says the Lord Almighty, and see. Just do it and see what happens. Test and see if I will not throw open the floodgates of heaven and pour out so much blessing that there will not be room enough to store it. Here we actually have permission. God says, you know what? I know it may be hard for you to believe that living a generous life is actually going to make your life richer, but just try me out and see. And if you do, here's what you're going to discover, that I will open up the floodgates of heaven and I will pour out so much blessing that you won't even know what to do with it. Now here's an important clarifier here. In this passage, the blessing that God will pour out is not necessarily the same kind of blessing that you offered generously first. So what I mean is, if we read this to say, if I give my money, God's going to pour out more money on me. If I give my time, God's going to give me more time. We're misunderstanding this entire passage. See, when we are generous with our food, our resources, when we live our lives generously, yes, God will open up the floodgates of heaven and he'll pour out blessing on us, but the blessing looks different than what we've offered, what the offering looked like to begin with. The bottom line here is what God will return to you is actually stuff that will make your life richer than what you offered in the first place. Paul makes it really clear. Paul's a pastor. He's writing to a young pastor named Timothy in this letter. He says this about how to teach the people. He says, command the people to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, if they do that, do good, be rich in good deeds, generous and willing to share. If they do this, here's what's going to happen. They will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. Now, it's a little bit dense, but if you read this to say that if you're good, do good deeds and you're generous, then you get to go to heaven someday, and that's kind of how you have to do it, you're reading it the wrong way. What Paul's actually saying to Timothy is, if you're generous, here's what happens. You open up the doorway to a life that is truly rich. Again, here's the point. If we keep measuring the richness of life in the same way, about how much money do we have, how much leisure time do we have, how extravagant are the vacations that we can take, what am I able to do for myself, then here's the thing. We'll never find true happiness, true fullness, or true abundance. And here's how I can say that, because we have more things as a society now, those kinds of things, wealth, leisure, pleasure, we have more of those things at our disposal than any society in human history, and we are not happier. I'll say that again. We have won the best of what the world has to offer, trying to find a happy life, a full life, and it has left us wanting. What Malachi is saying, what Paul's saying to Timothy is, hey, you know what happens when you're generous? When you're generous, when you're willing to let go of some stuff, when you're willing to offer some stuff, you make room. Just like decluttering your house, you make room for things that actually will bring you abundance. And it's not just more money. It's not just more pleasure. It's not just more leisure. The stuff that will make your life truly rich. You want to know what make your life truly rich? I love this. The Bible says this, and science data backs this up. Documented benefits of generosity living. The stuff that makes life really rich are relationships. moods, true joy, true happiness. Generosity will boost your mood. It'll boost your physical health. It'll give you a richer lifespan, not just a longer life, but a more joy-filled life, a life of deeper connection. You'll leave behind a richer legacy. Not based on what you amass for yourself or the empire you build for yourself, but by living a generous life. These are all data-driven, documented results of living generously. So why not pivot? This is what Paul's saying. This is what Malachi is saying. Why not pivot? Why not pivot and just become more generous? Let some things go so that then our lives are, there's room to receive things that actually make life truly life, that make life truly abundant, blessings that will make your life rich and happier, things that you cannot buy or earn for yourself, but God is pleased to give you if you just free up a little bit of room. Test it out. You don't have to take my word for it. You know, God says you don't even have to take my word for it. Test it out, right? So if we go back to these three things. If you want more generosity in your life, first just notice, not what you lack, but notice how well God has provided for you. And then trust that his word, although it's hard sometimes, he's a God who has demonstrated that he's always steering you towards what's good. He's not going to deprive you of anything. And finally, if you're just not sure, try it out. And see what happens. See, back to those disciples on Lake Gennesaret, the Sea of Galilee, there on the shore, all they did that day when Jesus called them is they took a step. They didn't know where it was all going, but they decided, looking at the best of what the world could offer them, a boat full of fish overflowing, they decided that maybe there was something more to life than how they had measured life before. And so all they did is they took a step. And when they did, they discovered that following Jesus, truly following Jesus, listening to his word, his difficult words, his counterintuitive wisdom, that it actually is a richer way to live.
Thanks for listening to the Pathfinder Church Message Podcast. If you'd like to hear more messages like this, hit the subscribe button. You can also find more resources at our website, pathfinderstl.org.